You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Paul.
Hi, Bob. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay, Paul. Now, as you know, and I know, but some people don't, I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. You're Paul Bloom, psychologist, writer, bon vivant, and also publisher of the Falsely Modest Small Potatoes newsletter. So, now, Paul, when I call you a bon vivant, do you know what recent activity of yours I have in mind?
Where I have heaved bonely. No, I don't.
Well, here's the thing. You know, some of us, we find out, like an eclipse is coming, we find out we're in the 89% zone, as I was, and I say, well, I guess that's my lot in life. I'm just a poor working man. I can't afford to fly all over the world to get totality and sip a fine Chardonnay as the darkness descends. You know, I'm just a regular person. What was your eclipse experience like, Paul?
Full totality.
It was totality.
I would think that your Buddhism would reject totality as an illusion, as something that we aspire to, but the aspiration itself is mistaken. But I basically married well 6 months ago. My wife made reservations at Niagara Falls. Mm-hmm. We went there. We met with her sister and their kids. Mm-hmm. And then as the day was approaching, we saw clouds. So we got in the car and we drove 2 hours west. We ended up in a parking lot with a butcher shop, and everybody in the butcher shop came out. And then we had the glasses.
Don't try to associate yourself with a common man, Paul. Come on.
I enjoyed the eclipse with the people.
Mm-hmm. You were elbow to elbow with mere butchers.
It was something. You sent me pictures from what you saw, and it also seemed impressive. Was it awe-inspiring for you? Was it transcendent?
Well, the pictures, on my smartphone, I went into manual settings and shut it down to 1/12,000th of a second shutter speed. So it actually looked really cool, but just not what it actually looked like. I mean, you had to shut it down that much to get anything at all without being blown out. Even an 89% eclipse is surprisingly bright. Yeah. So it looks great. It looks actually like a moon at night surrounded by dark clouds. But you tell me, what was the real thing like? I was surprised at 89%. I was starting to feel a little momentum toward darkness and thinking it would be really cool if this persisted, but it didn't. But were you surprised by how close you had to get to 100% before it got dramatic? It seems like you have to get pretty close.
Yeah, and it has to do with the logarithmic nature of visual perception, apparently, where big drops in the actual light are perceived as much smaller, but then you get to a certain point and it's really dark. Now, I thought it was going to get pitch black and you just see the stars, and it wasn't quite like that. But that was, to me, the big experience, when it gets dark and cold, and then you just kind of wonder for a little bit, what if the sun doesn't come out and then we all die? It just seems that the feeling of that was really something.
Isn't it kind of surprising that it has time to get cold?
Yeah, all of a sudden it gets cold. Talking to my cousin, she's in Boston, and she said she's putting on her coats and everything. Brought coats, it gets cold.
Imagine if this were 5,000 years ago, and you were
a shaman, and you had predicted it, and you had said, "Everybody stand here. Here's my prediction. I pray to God this is going to happen. You got to really, I can make this happen whenever I want."
Now, does something like that happen in the Mark Twain? There's a Mark Twain time travel.
Connecticut Yankee
in King Arthur's court. He goes back. Yeah. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm imagining that. Anyway, he impresses them in some respects.
That would do it. I gotta say, I'm pretty impressed. I mean, go with science. Just to the second, you know exactly when it's going to happen, and it's this very tangible demonstration of just the power of science.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, in some ways, we've been able to do this for a long time, but to the second, this is when it's going to get dark. It's neat.
It's cool. Next time I may do what you did and fly business class to wherever I have to. Fly business class from Toronto to Niagara Falls. Is that what you did?
I actually just had my limo take me there. It's just quicker. If you find yourself in Barcelona, south of Barcelona, in next summer, that'll give you another one.
That would be cool. The summer after this one?
Yeah. And then there's one in Egypt coming up. These are
that would be cooler.
So, you know,
pyramids.
This is a new life thing you could imagine. I gotta say, I enjoyed it. I liked it, you know, the family and the common people from the butcher shop.
Yeah.
But it didn't really, you know, I was reading these New York Times articles before. Everybody was saying how it's going to change your life and it's the biggest experience of your life. It was nice.
Yeah. Well, this is the life of an entitled hedonist, Paul. It's never quite enough.
It's never quite enough. I'm just chasing the next thing. And if only
you're on a hedonic treadmill, as they say in your line of work.
I should just reread Why Buddhism Is True. And I'd realize that aspiring towards these things is
I recommend that.
But I should buy myself another copy.
We all should. So, Paul, too much has happened since we last
spoke. A lot has happened.
We should not wait so long. We waited 3 weeks this time and too much happened.
We should do this daily.
I think so. It's amazing.
This is the thing.
So Danny Kahneman died, and I thought of you immediately. I thought it's too bad I don't have a podcast with. Well, first I thought I'm sorry about that, but then I thought it's too bad I don't have a podcast scheduled immediately with Paul Bloom. Should we remind people who aren't super conversant? Danny Kahneman became kind of burst on the scene, the popular scene, with his book Thinking Fast and Slow.
Yeah.
Based largely, to some significant extent, on work he had actually done, important experiments he had done with his co-author Amos Tversky.
Yep.
And do you think, I mean, we now live in an age where cognitive bias is a pretty common term, certainly confirmation bias is, but I think cognitive bias more broadly, that wasn't so true 30, 40 years ago. Did his book play like a big role in that, do you think?
Yeah, I think in the field, his work with Tversky was, you know, earth-shaking, was fantastic, and just totally provided a robust demonstration that our minds don't work on logical principles, don't work exclusively using probabilities, but we're subject to all sorts of biases. We're subject to biases involving, you know, salient events are thought of as more probable. We ignore background probabilities, base rates, leads us into all sorts of troubles. And also we have a very strong confirmation bias, or my side bias, which is something you've talked about a lot. And Kahneman and Tversky just lay that all out. And, you know, he won the Nobel Prize for his work. Kahneman, if Tversky was alive, he would have won it with him. And, you know, I got to say, there's always, some of my colleagues are not the nicest people. You know, some of my colleagues, you know, they're in the mix. I've never heard anybody say anything bad about Kahneman. He's just this sweet, smart guy. Everyone was on Twitter talking about their experiences with him. He was generous. He was kind. He was wise. I knew him to talk to him, and he was always just like a decent guy. And despite the status he had, you know, we don't have many Nobel Prize winners in our field. He was surprisingly humble at times. Mm-hmm. Just willing to acknowledge his own mistakes.
And he once laughed at one of my jokes, by the way.
Okay.
I remember these kinds of things.
I told him once about this project I was very excited by. And I just laid at it, and he said to me, I can't do the accent, but he said to me, oh, that doesn't sound like it will work. That doesn't sound very interesting at all. But it was very nice when he said it.
Mm-hmm.
He was right.
He was Israeli originally. And a little asterisk, given how much Israel is in the news, is he was pretty far left. He was pretty progressive on the Palestine issue, as I recall. I don't think he wrote or talked about it a lot, but even by today's standards, I think he was fairly left of center. So did he do loss aversion? Did he and Tversky do loss? So that's the idea that, what's the standard experiment? Like, if somebody offers to buy some mug from you for like $5, you won't, even though you could replace it and it has no particular sentimental value, and you could replace it for $3 or something, right? Is that the idea?
So there's two separate phenomena that are linked, but they're sort of separable. One is what he called an endowment effect, which is once you own something, it matters more to you. So you would, you know, you would only pay $5 for a mug, but once you have the mug, I've got to cost me $7 to take it away from you. Just the mere ownership of things gives them value, which is a very cool finding and replicated in many ways. The second thing is more general. And maybe, I think some of his findings really show irrationalities, failures of reasoning. Loss aversion to me makes sense. It's that losing $5 is worse than getting $5 is good. And
yeah, I mean, to me, it makes sense in evolutionary terms in the sense that you don't want to get a reputation as someone who can be ripped off or as some, you know, either as somebody who people can steal things from or they can just kind of like out bargain. That would be my
that's one way of looking at it. I mean,
seat of the pants explanation.
Another way is more general, which is just that bad things tend to be more bad then good things are good. There's a general finding in psychology called a negativity bias, where you focus more on the negative. Because if you think about the worst thing that could happen to you and the best thing, the worst is much worse. Like, for we would include you dying, for instance. Everybody you love dying. And that's from a genetic point of view, that's awful. Good things are just, you know, more reproductive opportunities, more status, and so on. And so bad things tend to be worse. And that was one of his findings. And this connects to, so he became very well known for his biases work. Now, foundational stuff, replicable, serious, practical relevance. And then later on in his career, he did work on happiness and really did some wonderful findings showing the dissociation between experienced happiness. You know, if you ask people, how are you doing right now? Versus what he called remembered happiness, where it says, how's your life going? And he found that these two were very different. And throughout his career, he changed his mind over what we should focus on. At one
what
point,
was what was the answer? His final answer on the subject.
His final answer, I think this is in his TED talk. I might be wrong though, but his final answer was remembered happiness. That we should sort of build our life, curate our lives in such a way that we're thinking about it afterwards, we'll think we've lived a good life. And I know this, and there's a great disagreement he has with Dan Gilbert, a friend of mine at Harvard, who's very much into experienced happiness. He thinks remembered happiness is sort of an illusion. But it's such a
takeaway
cool,
I remember from his book is his best-selling happiness book. I just remember kind of amounting to happiness is so complicated, there's barely any point in talking about it. Am I misremembering?
Oh, Dan's book. No, there are some really good. The book was really beautifully written. A lot of really interesting insights. And I guess I think the main takeaway is that we are very bad at projecting what will make us happy. We have all of these ideas what would make us happy. Everything from sort of big ideas like money, material possessions, that's the way to get happy, all the way to the idea that missing a train by just like 30 seconds will upset us more than 5 minutes or something. And so many of our intuition will make us happier, just systematically mistaken. And that's good to know.
It is good to know.
I'll just say one thing else about Kahneman, which is from a distance, his relationship with Amos Tversky was this extraordinary collaboration, the best known collaboration in psychology, one of the best in the sciences in general. But Michael Lewis wrote a book called The Undoing Project, which is talking about their careers, their work together. And he tells the story of their relationship. And it was a troubled one. It was a troubled one. I talk about this in my Small Potatoes newsletter. But Kahneman was jealous of Tversky. And everybody thought that Tversky.
Did he get Tversky, more attention at first?
Yeah. Tversky was thought of as the genius and won the MacArthur Genius Award.
Yeah.
Pile up honorary degrees like anything. And Kahneman, who's by any accounts one of the smartest people in the field, was thought of as a solid one, the serious one, you know, sort of straight man. And this grated on Kahneman. Tversky wouldn't give him credit for things, Tversky. And in part, it wasn't because Tversky just thought, the idea of getting credit and everything is ridiculous. It's a ridiculous request. Who cares? Mm-hmm. But there was times almost a sadism in their relationship. Kahneman tells the story of how he got an offer from Harvard, and he told Tversky, and Tversky's first response was, "They really wanted me, you know."
Oh man, that's harsh.
And that's the thing. And at a certain point,
probably a lie too. Do we know if it was true?
True. Everyone wanted Tversky. Students call him Famous Amos. You know, this, and you know, I met him once. He gave a talk at University of Arizona when I really gave a talk. He came to my office for the 30-minute meeting. We spoke. Boy, he was so bored. So bored as I spoke. He was the kind of genius who made no pretense. He was a lot less of a sweet guy than Kahneman.
So there's a lot of parallels here with between, you know, their relationship and my relationship with you, right? Like you fly around being celebrated and I resent it and am arguably doing really the hard work. Right?
I often think of it that way, but I don't, I'm not cruel about it. I don't mention it. I give
you
credit.
Belittle my accomplishments sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've been tormenting me, for example, this is a little different. You've been tormenting me with a modest error I made on the last podcast. How many times have you emailed me about that, Paul, and texted me and really DM'd me? It's like relentless.
Go there. You were.
I should own up to it. I should own up to it. Last time we spoke.
It couldn't have been a worse error. It wasn't. Okay. So last time we spoke.
This is what I mean. This is what I'm saying. You could have put that in a nicer way. You could have said it could have been a worse error, right? But you didn't. You said it could not have been a worse error. See, these are different. You get the distinction?
It could have been racial.
Yeah, it wasn't racial. It was gender related. It was gender related.
I'm an older guy.
Why, when I was a boy and you heard NCAA basketball playoffs, you thought of men, right? By the way, did you know that this year, for the first time ever, the women's finals got a higher viewership on TV than the men's finals?
Does that disappoint you?
No, not at all. No. And you know why it is? Because of the great Caitlin Clark.
Ah, I have heard Caitlin Clark.
Who, no less a figure than Bill Bradley. This is actually breaking news. This has not been reported. No less a figure than Bill Bradley, New York Nick, Rhodes Scholar, U.S. Senator, and known for his passing ability, has called the greatest passer he's ever seen.
Really?
Yeah. I may be violating confidence here, but I'm just going out there with it. He said it. That led me to watch her. And she's amazing. She's completely amazing. She has this like God's eye view of the court and how things are going to unfold. You know, whichever hockey player it was who said, don't skate to where the puck is, skate to where it's going to be. She knows where things are going to be. Sadly, her team lost in the finals. All this is my way of minimizing the wrath I'm going to get from lovers of women's basketball when I admit what happened during our last podcast.
I said
I had the weirdest experience on the radio. NPR must have screwed up because I turned on the radio and they said Princeton will play, I guess it was West Virginia, in the next round of the NCAAs. And I thought Princeton didn't even make the NCAAs. And we now know that, and I was, as soon as I found out what had happened, which is that, of course, they were talking about the women's team, I immediately thought of that old riddle, the punchline of witches, or not punchline, but the answer is... Well, you're supposed to guess, like, how could it be that the surgeon looks down and says, I can't operate on him. He's my son. And people go, I don't know. How could that possibly be? Because you've already heard in the story that the father was in the car accident or something.
Yeah.
And people just,
you know, they gave in a study a couple of years ago, college students, the same riddle. And most of them didn't get it. This is, you know, a world full of female surgeons and every dancer's courses. The surgeon is the boy's mother. But people didn't. And then people often had these weird confabulations. They said, gay marriage. It's gay marriage. Or the father was a priest. And then, you know, he's really father. And so, and they give these bizarre, it was a ghost. And rather than simply assume that the surgeon could be a woman, they had all of these bizarre things. very similar to what happened to you 3 weeks ago.
I'm feeling better. So it isn't my age so much.
No, it isn't.
It's something it's darker. It's something darker than age.
Something darker in a human psyche. Mm-hmm. But the fact that you're owning up for it and just talking about it,
it's
lot of credit.
It's one of those things people don't know about our relationship, that I'm the kind of guy who would do that, and you're the kind of guy who would torment me about it when you're not flying around watching total eclipses. That's what people don't understand.
Wait, that's a line from the song You're So Vain.
Right. Total eclipse. It's perfect. Yeah, I didn't want to mention that because I'm not the kind of guy to rub it in, Paul. Hmm. That what you did is equated with vanity in popular lore. I wasn't going to see. I would not bring that up.
I didn't even get the reference. It just suddenly came to me. This is a very mm-hmm. hurtful moment. Normally, when mm-hmm. you say hurtful things about me, I remember later on in the day, but this is in real time. This also connects, by the way, your appreciation of your own flaws and biases and the aim of becoming a better person brings us back to Kahneman, which is in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, which he was very hesitant to write and bring out. And he sent a draft to a bunch of his friends saying, is this going to destroy my career? Because if so, I'll just burn it. And they said, no, it's a good book. So, but in it,
what was his fear? Why would it have been bad for him? Because it's too popular or what?
I think he felt it just wasn't good, that it would embarrass him due to his low quality, but it's actually very good. It's maybe it's because of his popularization. Mm-hmm. He wasn't, obsessed with his, he just felt a bit foolish doing it. He's not.
No, he did cite some experiments of others that wound up getting caught up in the replication crisis, but that wasn't his work, right?
No, it wasn't. And in fact, but he was, so this is a story to his credit. Like this is, what happened now is to your credit. He cited a lot of social psychology priming stuff. I forget the social
that was
priming
stuff.
Results.
I
forget the exact.
We should say to people,
presented.
It's like, and this is the kind of thing that I just was immediately suspicious of. Like when they say, if we handed them a glass of cold water before they walked into the room, they were colder to people than if we handed them a glass of hot water. I'm like, wait, why would that be? And it's exactly the kind of experiment that was discredited.
Yeah, so all sorts of experiments like that. Like you give people a resume, which is it has a little backing, so it's heavy. They think the candidate's more substantive and deep, heavy. Mm. People who have, so it's stuff like that. And he says in this book, look, this is going to seem crazy to you, but it's rock solid. You can't deny it. And then it turned out that he discovered later, as the whole field discovered, a lot of stuff didn't hold true, didn't replicate. Mm-hmm. And he was upset. He wrote a letter. And I've seen this letter. He wrote a letter to his social psychology colleagues, just very upset, saying, you have to get your act together. You have to get together and figure out what's wrong. Try to replicate these findings and everything. Mm-hmm. And nobody likes being chastised by a Nobel Prize winner. He would take every opportunity he could to say big chunks of my book were wrong, and I feel mm-hmm. bad about it, and so on.
Now,
there's an idea of scientists as sort of very egotistically pushing their own theory, ignoring all evidence to the contrary, and this is the key to success. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes that's true. I think a certain bullheadedness, a certain unwillingness to back down could be very valuable for somebody.
Oh, yeah.
And if you're in a community of people where other people are doing that, the same thing with their own theories, there's some sort of communal correction. One reason science works is that you don't trust individuals to go falsify their own theories while we falsify each other's theories. Mm-hmm. But Kahneman is an exception to this cynical view, where he really was very open to changing his mind.
Now, just quickly, some work that Lita Kosmides did, possibly in conjunction with John Tooby. These are two evolutionary psychologists that I think is kind of underappreciated outside of Ev Psych circles, but which I think holds up, was to show that one of the seeming cases of human irrationality that I guess... Did Kahneman and Tversky document this? Is this called the Wasson something or other?
It was the Wason selection task.
Wason, W-A-S-O-N.
Yes.
Anyway, I mean, you may remember better than I, but what Lita showed was that actually, if you if you make it more of like a real life challenge of the kind that our ancestors would have faced on in their hunter-gatherer villages, which is to say, figure out who's cheating, figure out who's lying, people do much better on it. And that's like super interesting. I don't know if she actually had, I don't know if they had contestations over that and they got into arguments about it, or he even addressed it. I don't know, but
I don't know if
there was some of that, but
argued about it. But it was a big argument around Kahneman Tversky's work. The findings were pretty solid. You could easily replicate them in all sorts of ways. But the interpretation was not. And a lot of people, and maybe Tversky to some extent, said, it's just people are kind of stupid. Our powers are limited. And then other people, certainly Leda Cosmides, also Gyrki Gerenzer, saying, no, what's happening here is that we've evolved, we have a sort of evolved mind. And this leads us to be very good at certain things that fit the environment in which we evolved in. Catching cheaters, making probability estimates based on the experiences we've had and so on. We're just brilliant at it. Where we do poorly is in cases where everything is kind of pulled away from our evolutionary environment. So given numbers and statistics, we often get confused. Given abstract logical problems, we get confused. But make it real, and then people will do very well. And there's a very productive debate over the extent to which that's true.
This is related to my being a little resistant to their system one, system two division.
Yeah.
There are these two systems of thought. It seemed to me it was actually a little more complicated than that, but I never really articulated that well enough to defend this position.
I mean, if there's any, Kahneman himself, you know, if you asked him, I heard him being asked, what do you think's the part of your book you're most likely to be mistaken? He said, system one is your gut feeling, your automatic response, your quick intuitive response. And a lot of the research focused on that. System two is the sort of more contemplative, reasoned response. And that's allowing you to see that these things are fallacies in the first place. But Kahneman says system two is just a homunculus. System two just pushes the question back. It's like, how does the mind work? Well, you have a really smart guy in it. We'll call him system two. Well, but that doesn't, in some way, that just defers the question. What makes this guy smart? How does that work?
Right. So, tell me something. This is a segue. Does the rationalist community, which you're more conversant in than I am, I think, and closer to being a part of than I am.
Yeah.
Are you polyamorous, for example? Well, you laugh.
I didn't think that's coming.
Yeah. No, I didn't either. No. That came from system. Which system is it that just coughs stuff up without thinking about it?
That's for system one. Yeah.
That came from that system.
I'm barely amorous.
Yeah, I know that feeling. Do the rationalists celebrate Kahneman and Tversky? Do you know?
So I am a fan of the rationalists because I think the ideas are really, and the ideas they put forward are very important and everything. And I read some people, mostly Scott Alexander, who I'm a big fan of and has changed my
head. Well, see, you're the person I first heard about him from years and years ago. That's how I know. And he is, what is he? He's probably the best and most popular and prolific writer among the rationalists.
Yeah.
His blog.
And he just writes.
Flight Star Codex originally. Now
Astro Codex, yeah. I think I don't always agree with him. I think he's brilliant. And I think he's a brilliant, great writer. Really cool ideas and changed my mind on a lot of things. But I'm in no sense a member of the community. I don't know anybody personally who's a rationalist. I don't go to their clubs. I'm not polyamorous. I'm not, you know. But I would defend their program. And I do think that they're very sensitive to these biases. In particular, and I've heard you talk about Kahneman's work before, and what you say is there should be more emphasis on the thing you're most interested in, the emotional side of our tribal biases, less interested that we ignore base rates or whatever. But they did a lot of work on this, and you get to what's called confirmation bias, my side bias. Julia Galef calls it the soldier mindset, where we just really want to defend our ideas. We are resistant to falsification. We are tribal when it comes to the information we seek out. and everything. And I think the rationalists are exquisitely sensitive to that. They may be in the end guilty of it because it's hard not to be, but they try their best not to be.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, my view is, you're right, I'm most concerned about the cognitive biases that are conducive to tribalism and lead to wars and political polarization and so on. Another one that I think, and I think two things. I think the emotional side of cognitive biases, well, maybe generally, but certainly in the case of attribution error, is underemphasized. And the fact that, to some extent, getting your confirmation bias under control can be a challenge of becoming more aware of the feelings you have, the feelings that arise when you see news that either confirms or seems to disconfirm your worldview. But I also, there's another cognitive bias I'm trying to gin up attention to, which is attribution error in its more refined sense. And actually, in the last issue of the Non-Zero newsletter, if people want to go there, I show how that can be applied to coverage of international politics and how it can get in the way. But so, yeah, that's all true. That is kind of my shtick. Yeah. I actually, the way I put it when I reviewed Steve Pinker's book Enlightenment Now for Wired was, we need more talk about Eastern Enlightenment and less about Western Enlightenment, the Western Enlightenment. Anyway, back to where I was going to go. Did you have something to say before I go to this conversation I had with Robin Hanson?
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
You either say, I saw your conversation with Hanson, and I saw you talk about this before in another context. And somewhere in there, you said a version of what you just said to me, which is mindfulness meditation is in some sense a potential cure or solve for this level of bias. And I understand how that is in theory. So Julia Galef says, the problem is we hold our identities too tightly. We hold our views too tightly. And in some way, I know the logic of mindfulness meditation is you don't hold things tightly at all. You see them from a distance, you pull back. But do you think it's true in practice? Do you think if you got 1,000 people and trained them to meditate, they would be less biased in this way?
It's a good question. I haven't seen good work on that. I would imagine that if you looked at 1,000 people who had just emerged from a meditation retreat, I mean, it's very hard to hang on to what you get at one of these. They would, and then you put them on social media, they would be more aware that when somebody in the other tribe posts something, they feel this aversion to the information rising up, almost a literal dislike of the information. They want to find ways to undermine it, things wrong with it, and so on. And I would say, forget the meditation part. Just try this next time you're on social media. Just pay attention to the subtle feelings that arise when you see things from your tribe and the other tribe and see if you don't notice something. And it's very hard. Applied mindfulness is very hard. I'm not great at it. But that I do think is what is one, not the only, but one approach to combating biases like, well, attribution error, but also confirmation bias and some other things. I mean, ultimately, it wouldn't surprise me if all cognitive biases have an affective component. I mean, affect is the thing that guides our reason, as Hume said, and as we believe, I think. But yeah.
So I think that's true. I think that's true. You take something like the biases involved in assessing probability of an event, and one of the discoveries Kahneman Tversky made, which in some ways is intuitive, is that a salient event that really bothers people and hits people very hard tends to be judged as more probable. So you have people who think that there should be armed guards around schools because of school shootings. And that children should be trained to avoid school shootings and so on. And this, and some parents saying, I can't send my kid to school now, or I don't want to send my kid to school in the States, I've heard people say, because of all the school shootings. And then you tell them that, yeah, but it's actually much more dangerous to drive cross country or something. The odds are really low. Mm-hmm. And they say, but in my gut, I feel terrified. I'm terrified of school shootings. I'm terrified of terrorism. I'm terrified that some Trump supporter will get a gun and shoot me. And you say, well, those are like infinitesimal compared to real worries, but it doesn't feel that way. I'll also just put in a plug. There's a book by Julia Galef, who's a prominent rationalist herself, called The Scout Mindset, which tries to work out practical, usable ways to sort of work against this bias and, you know, setting yourself up to think in terms of devil's advocates. I actually think that the best way to do it is socially, having other people around different views. It's very hard to sort of talk yourself out of your own biases.
Yeah, well, Robin Hanson was mentioning things like prediction markets and he sees, social solutions generally as important in correcting these kinds of biases. So I had him on the podcast just a couple of weeks ago, and one interesting thing to me was his backstory about kind of the origin of the rationalist. So Eliezer Yudkowsky has become more prominent lately as the AI, sci-fi AI doomer in chief. Yeah. By sci-fi, I mean like the AI is going to take over and kill us all. That's the way he puts it. And he is a big part of the rationalist community. And he had this blog, Less Wrong, that was a kind of organizing, kind of a mecca for the rationalist community and helped get it off the ground. But before that, Robin Hanson had this blog called Overcoming Bias, bias in the sense of cognitive bias, not racial bias or anything. And he and Eliezer interacted on that a lot and had these discussions. And by Robin's account, I hope I'm not mischaracterizing him, you can go back and check. Eliezer then went over and started his own blog with the goal, I think Robin is saying, of kind of conflating rationalism with AI doomerism. In other words, I don't know if Robin quite used the word cult, but anyway, I'm sure he would have been happy to if he didn't. But the point was, Robin's not an AI doomer. He's a libertarian, something of a techno-optimist, I think. And of course, there are libertarian doomers, but there are a lot of the techno-optimists are libertarians. And, he says there's actually no logical connection between rationalism and AI doomerism. It's a matter of opinion whether a rational person is an AI doomer. But it's like, by his account, Eliezer made this kind of something you had to sign on to be part of his club. And then the club was called rationalism. And so he just, metaphorically. And so I hadn't heard that. Interesting.
I hadn't heard. I take Hanson at his word. He was there. But if that was the goal, it didn't seem to work out. I mean, I've been reading Scott Alexander stuff for a long time, pretty much. And AI doom never comes up. There's a million other things they worry about.
Never's
too strong, but rarely comes up.
He wrote a piece in early 2023, I think, when this stuff really got going. With, GPT, ChatGPT, pretty alarmed. Yeah. His point was just, we don't understand these things. It was pretty alarmed.
Yep.
I think you're right that, Eliezer hasn't gotten 100% sign on. I also think, I don't know when he started his blog, Less Wrong, but there's I had a conversation with Eliezer like 10 or 12 years ago on what was then Blogging Heads TV, the precursor of the Non-Zero podcast. And at that point, he was in transition. He started out as a techno-optimist. The singularity is going to be a great thing. He started this thing, I think, called the Singularity Institute with like some Silicon Valley money. Everything was going to be great. And he gradually became alarmed. And that conversation of mine with him is interesting because he's like in mid-conversion. He's getting worried. And so I don't know how that timetable aligns with Robin's account. But he was pretty alarmed. I mean, he was pretty alarmed by then. But he started out as one of these naive singularity worshipers, which is a position I never understood. I'm much closer to understanding the sci-fi doomer position.
No, I mean, if we could talk about how likely it is, but I think we would agree that that having the AIs come and, you know, kill us all would be a bad thing. I actually think
I'm opposed to that. I want to go on record.
Yeah.
As being opposed to that. You see, although some people would say that makes you a speciesist.
Yeah, it's true.
Because the if the AI is sentient, it will be a bigger, better species with richer consciousness. And, you know, everything is impermanent, as you may have heard.
There's also something discussed in the rationalist community, which is that we should avoid saying such things now. Because if the AIs take over, they will monitor us and then we will be punished for our getting in their way.
There's even a scenario where I think it's a Terminator-like scenario where they come back from the future. If you're bad-mouthing them now, this may be the thing that's called, what is
somebody's
it?
Somebody's basilisk or something.
Rocco's bat. I had him on the podcast, the guy who came up with the basilisk thing.
Really?
And yeah, supposedly, I just yesterday, the way this happened was I was reading this, to me, extremely naive piece by Mark Andreessen on how wonderful everything is associated with AI is going to be. And he linked to this thing where someone was recounting their traumatic experience in the rationalist community at one of the rationalist institutes and alluded to someone who actually committed suicide. And one of the dark thoughts on their mind in the days before had been Rocco's basilisk. So there you go. Fear that, you know, of some, I think it's a kind of Terminator scenario.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a general, Hansen is very critical of the rationalist movement, but I think you have to pull apart the ideas of a movement versus its particular character and the people who run it. And you could adopt ideas without liking the community. This has come up in psychology, which is there's a whole thing about a replication crisis. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of accusations that the people who are most concerned about failures to replicate and go around saying your study isn't done right, or this must be fraudulent or so on, are kind of jerks. And they have been guilty of bad behavior. And we could argue about whether or not that's true. I think it is in some cases, not in others. But it's a separate question to whether they're right to worry about the crisis in replication. I mean, for all I know, the people, you know, scientists who determine the trajectory of the eclipse are just awful people. You wouldn't disregard their work. And I think people tend to conflate these two. They don't like the rationalist community because they're polyamorous, because there's this character, that character. And then they say, well, rationalism is a bad idea.
No, I say judge them by it there.
With effective altruism, where, you know, one of the guys who's talking about it the most is now in prison for 25 years. But I don't think that says the slightest thing about whether effective altruism is a good idea or a bad idea.
I agree. And I actually had a good conversation with Rob Wiblin a couple months ago on the podcast. He's a big EA, the big EA kind of podcast is called 80,000 Hours, and he's a co-host. I think there's been a lot of kind of crude stereotyping of both the EA people and the rationalist people, and a certain amount of facile conflation of them, even though there is sociological overlap.
Yeah.
And logical overlap. I mean, EA is a rationalist approach to philanthropy.
But, yeah. I mean, in some way, I feel about EA, effective altruism, like, in the broadest sense, is that the sort of thing one could sensibly be against? I remember the first time I heard the phrase evidence-based medicine. And, you know, really? Like, what, you prefer
what
non-evidence-based medicine? And so the idea of effective altruism in general is you figure out the best way to help people that has the most effects. You don't do it by your gut feelings or your affiliation. And this could be done poorly, but it seems like a great idea. It seems like such a great idea. And, you know, Freddie DeBoer, writer I respect, but had a very critical response. Everybody knows this part of it. Everybody agrees this. But he's deeply wrong. Most of the charity we give to is based on gut feelings. It's devoted to helping out some organization next door, which wastes an enormous amount of money and doesn't go to where it needs it most. So I'm a big fan of effective altruism.
Mm-hmm.
I have a segue ready to go here, which is,
well, you know, the paywall will soon descend, but go ahead. And well, I just want to cap the last discussion. I would just like to cap by saying two things. A couple of weeks ago, I had in the Non-Zero newsletter a kind of critique of Jan LeCun, who is another, I think, naive techno-optimist on AI, who's the chief scientist at Meta.
Yeah.
But also, as far as the, you know, the basilisk thing.
Yeah.
I just want to say, I, for one, welcome our new robot overlords.
Well, okay. This is my segue, which is, so there are people who worry about AI, smart. Mm-hmm. There are people who don't worry about AI, you know, they're also smart people. Then there's people who assume that AI will eventually, you know, very quickly, in fact, come to dominate and rule us. And they want to hasten this event. They're the accelerationists or something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they would say some, and there's some version of it. I think Robin Hanson alluded to this a little bit, as, you know, don't be too speciesist. You know, our children are our children, but AI is our children, sort of. And who doesn't love their children? Let our children take over.
Well, I'm not sure Robin was saying that. I thought he was saying, I think it was more like, look, our children aren't a threat to us. And yeah. AI is our offspring. And I just thought, I'm not sure you can get from A to B there, Rob. Like,
yeah, I don't think
he was making what some people claim is the Larry Page argument. I think one of the two Google co-founders supposedly said to Elon Musk, if you're worried about them taking over and killing us, you're a speciesist. I don't think Robin is making that
fair
argument
enough.
That it's okay
fair
if they kill us all. I think fair he's enough. Saying they won't.
Yeah, he's saying they won't because they're our children. And
yeah.
Yeah. But this makes a connection to a TV show we were both watching called The Three Body Problem.
Ah, yes.
Where, and, you know, this would not give away too much. We're sort
good,
of
because you watched one more episode than we watched two episodes and then a bunch of family stuff intervened. So we haven't finished.
No, I put family stuff to the side when it comes to my obligation to watch good TV. So we finished episode 5 last night.
Oh, my God.
And it is getting better and better. But
no,
so this is not.
Yeah.
Have you read the book, by the way?
Book. No, I just read a Times piece saying that people in China are kind of upset. It's a Chinese at the way this, I think mainly the way it opens, because it depicts the Cultural Revolution as being so brutal. But
the revolution was brutal. Is it, well, really inappropriate?
It was,
to
but
say
man,
that?
That was a very bloody scene. Yes. I mean, I don't know whether things exactly like that happened or not. Anyway, they're not delighted. But the novel itself is a Chinese novel, right? It's written mm-hmm. by someone in China.
Yep. Yep. I read the first book and struggled through it and don't remember much of it. My son read the trilogy and loved it. It mm-hmm. was just wonderful. But the idea is, so here's the connection. The idea is that, when I put the level of, no spoilers, just a trailer level, which is we encounter aliens and aliens are going to attack. And we know this, they're going to come to us and we're in trouble. But
see, you're already a little ahead of episode 2, so I'd be careful.
No. There's a community of people
mm-hmm.
who are with the aliens.
Right. And actually, I will say one thing that's not much of a plot spoiler. I think if they need an excuse for how brutal, well, I'll say this on the other side of the paywall. What a great pay bait. This is like genius level stuff. It's almost as if we planned it. We didn't. It's just the kind of thing that occurs to you when you're a podcast entrepreneur.
I'm not working through the conversation with you, but you at the same time are checking the timestamps and getting this all calibrated, connecting it to previous guests. It's just,
yeah, there's only one system in this brain, Paul.
System
it's the
3.
Calculating, consciously rational system. Yep. Nothing happens by impulse here.
It's all orchestrated.
Planned. So I will continue. We will continue our discussion. And if you want to listen, you can do one of two things. You can become a paid subscriber to the Non-Zero newsletter, or you can become a paid subscriber to the Small Potatoes newsletter. If you think putting money in the pockets of people who fly business class to see total eclipses is like a worthy cause, do that. Right, Paul?
Business class is itself a compromise because there's first class. So
actually, I think on all those international flights, there's not, right?
There's different tiers.
By the way, not to brag,
I just got
invited to a conference that would mean free business class to Taiwan.
Nice.
Yeah. Nice. For some of us, free matters, Paul. Free matters to some of us. So anyway, you can go to either newsletter and become a paid subscriber.
Or both.
We should set up one of those mutual discount things.
We definitely should.
We should. And we will. So thanks, everybody, who's been with us this far. And perhaps particular thing to those who will be with us for the rest. But we love them all. We love all the people.
We do.
So now we're heading into overtime.